degrees in Philadelphia, WHYY.
I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Earlier this month, President Obama signed the Farm Bill, which took 2 years of wrangling and debating and millions of dollars of lobbying to become law. It calls for $956.4 billion in spending over the next 10 years. It's a complicated piece of legislation which benefits people living in rural and urban communities, as well as the rich and the poor. It includes agricultural subsidies and money for food stamps, known now as SNAP benefits, although both programs were cut. We asked Alan Bierga to walk us through the new law, its history, and what it took to get it passed. He covers agricultural policy for Bloomberg News, wrote a book called Endless Appetites, How the Commodities Casino Creates Hunger and Unrest. And Alan Bierga, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning. Good to be here.
Nice to have you with us. Why such an intense fight over this farm bill?
This particular farm bill ran straight into the buzzsaw that is the Tea Party. What you had was a bill that is traditionally pretty easy to pass because it pleases a lot of different constituencies. There's been this coalition of rural and urban lawmakers that have been behind this bill for about the last 40 years. You have rural lawmakers who want to safeguard farm subsidies, get programs for rural communities, and then you have urban lawmakers, predominantly Democrats, who want money for nutrition programs, food aid for poorer families. It's been this urban-rural coalition that's been passing this bill for decades. This particular time around, it ran into trouble because what you had was both a call for cuts to farm subsidies in Congress and also a willingness to cut into programs for the poor. So what in the House of Representatives, you had some real resistance to this bill. Just to give you a little bit of the history.
Sure, go ahead.
In 2012, the Senate overwhelmingly passed a version of the Farm Bill. The House of Representatives wouldn't even take it up. In 2013, the Senate again passed a farm bill by a wide margin. This time it went before the floor of the House of Representatives, but it failed. They ended up temporarily splitting the bill into two parts, one that cut farm subsidies, another bill that cut food stamps. Those were stitched together after they passed the House to be negotiated with the Senate. Now, in the end, what you got was something very similar to the Senate's package that they'd been passing all along. And what part of the difference in that was, frankly, changes in the political climate on Capitol Hill. After you had the government shut down last October, there was sort of a belief, especially among the Republican Party and Speaker John Boehner, that you just sort of needed to start passing bills differently in Congress to get anything done. So you started seeing more of a willingness of passing bills in general with more of the support of Democrats and maybe not all of the Republicans, but enough to get them through. Because of that, this time around, when the Farm Bill came up in early 2014, even though you still had that Tea Party opposition, and you certainly had Democrats who were upset about what remained to have some cuts in the food stamp program, you ended up with a coalition that could get this bill through. But there were some bumps along the way that this bill hasn't faced in the past, and that was very much because of the political climate on Capitol Hill.
And is this, when they talk about the sausage-making of legislation, is this a prime example?
It really is. And the Farm Bill is sort of almost a civics lesson because this is, if you read back to your 8th or 11th grade textbooks, this is how a bill gets passed. Somebody proposes a piece of legislation, different constituencies are attracted to it for their different reasons, compromises get made, it gets through Congress. Now, there are certainly a lot of people who are not happy with this Farm Bill, but it did get through and it did get passed in what has been a very dysfunctional Congress. And so last week when you saw President Obama and other people celebrating, they weren't even necessarily celebrating what they thought was perfect farm and food policy. They were celebrating the fact that a policy was able to get passed at all, which may seem like a pretty low bar in today's Washington, but it is the bar, and it was passed.
And the original Tea Party opposition, was it opposition to both subsidies and also to food aid?
It really was. Now, you have a little bit of nuance there because a lot of your Tea Party Republicans tend to be more rural areas. But even in this case, on this bill, surprisingly from a historical standpoint, you saw rural Republicans, Tea Party Republicans, opposing this bill because of the cost of farm subsidies. And part of that deals with how nationalized this political climate has become. You know, if you're in a rural lawmaker in a rural district that is predominantly Republican, and your big funders are coming from, say, Americans for Prosperity, which gets a lot of money from Koch Industries, if a lot of it comes from, you know, Club for Growth or Heritage Action or groups that are really into small government, those farm subsidies for the farmers in your district may not be as important to you as the ideology of lower spending in government. For example, of the Kansas congressional delegation. Now, when people think about a prototypical farm state, they may well think of Kansas, you know, endless wheat fields, some corn, a big rural economy. Five of the six members of that state's delegation voted against this farm bill, and it was the budget concerns. Now, they will take a look at the food stamp program, but there was concerns with farm subsidies as well. So it really was a general opposition to all spending, although you certainly saw an emphasis on those social programs that the Tea Party has always been very suspicious of.
Alan, you've written about the fact that something like 325 companies lobbied this bill to the tune of something like $150 million. Is that an unusual number of companies and amount of money to lobby a particular bill like this?
Well, it's interesting you bring that up, because since we were originally publishing those stories, new numbers have come up, and it went from 325 to 350. So it was even larger than we thought. It's not unusual from the standpoint of major legislation, but what it does do is underscore the importance of the Farm Bill, which, you know, a lot of your consumers in urban areas aren't going to be thinking of every day. But this is an important piece of legislation that touches a lot of people. So when you're talking, you know, $150 million in spending, 350 companies, those are numbers that usually you associate with, say, defense bills or budget bills or the really marquee pieces of legislation that get through Congress. It would be unusual if this were not a marquee piece of legislation, but when you take a look at what the Farm Bill really affects, it is. And it really is that big league piece of you know, law that a lot of companies, a lot of constituencies are going to be interested in.
And are we talking about a diverse group of companies, of these 350 companies that kind of cross the food and farm gamut?
Well, the food and farm gamut is pretty big in itself. You know, agriculture and food supports about 9% of all the jobs in the United States. There's about 2.6 million that are directly in farming. But then there's another more than 13 million of food service, of grocery stores throughout the chain. And that's going to affect Philadelphia and urban areas as well. So what you see is everything from, you know, your traditional commodity groups, your farmer groups, your farm bureaus, your National Farmers Union, your corn growers, to the agribusinesses, the Monsantos and the Archer Daniels Midlands and the Cargills of the world, to your food companies, you know, companies like Nestle, companies like Campbell's Soup, to then the grocers, the retailers, who have a big stake in the food stamp program. And that will be Kroger, that will be Walmart, that will be Safeway, Giant Eagle, Super Value. You have it. All of these companies have an interest in some aspect of this bill. And you see their names sprinkled throughout the 350 companies that did lobby this bill last year.
Well, as we know, there are cuts both to subsidies, but also to the food stamp or the SNAP program. How much, Alan, of the overall farm bill is devoted to SNAP benefits?
Well, food stamps and nutrition programs are, under the latest Congressional Budget Office estimate, about 80% of this bill.
Wow.
You know, there becomes a lot of fights over subsidies and commodity groups, but the biggest amount of spending is the food stamp program. The 10-year expense of this bill would be about $956 billion. Of that, around $750 is the food stamp program. And part of that is because we've had such a dramatic ramp up in the spending for this program over the past 5 years. You know, when you had the fiscal crisis and the Great Recession hitting in 2007, 2008, 2009, you saw enrollment and spending in food stamps doubling. And one of the things that concerns some of your fiscal conservative Republicans is even as the unemployment rate now has gone back down from, say, 10% to, I think, right now at 6.6, you have not seen enrollment in the food stamp program really going down in any sort of commensurate level. Part of that is because the government has been a lot more aggressive about getting participation rates higher and getting everybody who can qualify for this program into this program. So it's become a bigger budgetary item, which makes it a much larger part of this farm bill.
Well, as you've said, the House Republicans actually wanted to cut the food stamp or the SNAP programs or the food programs by something like $40 billion, ended up with $8.6 billion. But what does that mean to a household in this country?
Well, it's going to depend on what state you're in, because this was a key part of the compromise. So, as you said, at one point, the Republican-passed food stamp bill of last fall was calling for $40 billion in reduction. The Senate bill that had passed in 2013 called for $4 billion of reduction. The final number ended up being about 8.6, 8.7. Now, how they got to that number was by changing a payment threshold under a what's called the LIHEAP program.
Oh, sure.
Low-Income Heating and Energy Assistance Program. What they did was they took a provision that states were using in which they could qualify a family for up to maybe $90 a month more in food stamps if these states gave them, say, a dollar in home heating aid. That triggered the food stamp bonus. There was a feeling in Congress that this program, this provision, really wasn't meant to be used that way. So instead of the threshold being $1 for a household in this program, they're saying, you know, you got to give these households at least $20 before they can qualify for the extra food stamp aid. And then when all the bean counters did their calculations, they decided that that would probably be a disincentive to states to give that bonus to the tune of $8.7 billion over 10 years. Now, to walk you through this about how this affects a household.
Yes.
There were 16 states, including Pennsylvania, that participated in this program. No one loses their food stamp eligibility because of this change. And that was very important to the Democrats, because when the Republicans were making their cuts, they were doing things that were going to throw people off of food stamps. This change does not throw anyone off. But if you were participating in this program through LIHEAP, your family, your household, could lose $90 a month in benefits. Whether that happens is very much going to be dependent on what the states themselves decide to do. They could decide to raise their dollar to $20, but then that affects funding for other state programs. And so what you're going to see is you're going to watch this play out in the next months in different states as far as how do they react to this farm bill and the LIHEAP program. But that's where the changes are going to come. I mean, households in Pennsylvania, if they're in this program, could lose $90 a month in food stamp aid. The place to check is the state social services. How this plays out as the farm bill gets implemented, the exact details are yet to be known.
Well, and we're almost up in a break here, but it sounds like within this year, those effects will be felt by people?
There will be effects this year. It's all going to depend when states do their budget process of how they decide to react to what the farm bill has done. But, I mean, the concept was to cut back on aid for people receiving food stamps, and undoubtedly that will happen.
Well, we're going to take that short break and then get back to our conversation with Alan Bjerga. He covers agricultural policy for Bloomberg News. Wrote a book called Endless Appetites, How the Commodities Casino Creates Hunger and Unrest. He is walking us through the complicated but very important farm bill that was just passed into law. It took 2 years to become law. We're talking about what's in the bill and how we got to this place. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen if you have any questions or comments. We'll be talking about subsidies after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Executive Doctorate of Business Administration at Temple University's Fox School of Business supports WHYY. This 3-year applied research-focused degree is designed to provide experienced business leaders the skills to address tomorrow's challenges. Executive DBA students receive faculty mentorship, online collaboration, and the Fox School's reputation for high-quality research. Temple University Fox School of Business. Discover the power of Fox. Learn more at fox.temple.edu/executive-dba.
I'm Marty Moss Cohen. WHYY is beholden to you. Informing you is our top priority, and that also means being available on air and online. We know that many of you listen to WHYY.org at some point during the week. Let us know you value this service by clicking over to the support page and making a pledge. We will invest your contribution right back into the services you expect from us. WHYY.org. Thank you very much.
In the 50s and 60s, a generation of black disc jockeys rapped and rhymed on the radio.
You better believe it, Big Mommy or Big Daddy or Keen Teens, ladies and gentlemen, Commander Hot Rod.
African-American presence on the air changed the country.
With radio, the mic was open. You could call in and express yourself.
I'm Kenny Gamble, and the program is Going Black, the Legacy of Philly Soul Radio.
Sunday night at 6 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wain talking with Alan Birga about the Farm Bill. After a two-year battle in Congress, President Obama recently signed the bill into law, almost $1 trillion over the next 10 years. And again, we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Alan, this new bill, ends direct payments to farmers. Help us understand how that used to work and why it's not in the bill now.
Well, many a PhD dissertation has been written about the history of farm subsidies in the United States, so it gets really complicated. But the main thing that happened in terms of subsidies in the Farm Bill was there was this program called the Direct Payment Program, and essentially what it did was it was a check written to farmers kind of for being farmers. It was based on the historical acreage of the ground that you had planted, and it was simply a government transfer payment check given to farmers in part to help them manage their own operations. This was a legacy of an earlier farm bill in 1996, where the idea that these would be transitional payments while other subsidies were phased out, but other subsidies weren't phased out. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, in the past few years, we have seen record profitability on U.S. farms. That forecast just changed a little bit yesterday for times going forward, but the last few years have been really a bonanza for a lot of growers in the United States. So taking a look at the fact that you're seeing record profits and yet $5 billion going out automatically to people who are getting record profits, the direct payment program was simply indefensible politically, and the farm lobbies knew that they were going to have to give it up. They got a lot of the direct payment money back in the form of other programs that are based more on actual changes to prices in the market, the idea that you should target this aid to when the aid is actually more required. But this $5 billion went away. It does lead to less farm subsidy spending and maybe a little more rational sense of farm subsidy spending, a lot of people would tell you, because you're no longer just sending checks to farmers for being farmers.
And was money being spent or sent to millionaires, maybe even billionaires?
Well, that is an issue that has been, you know, really infuriating to a lot of folks who are opposed to farm subsidies for several years. Farm bills over the last few years have done a lot to rein in and tighten that. That's not to say that it doesn't happen, but there are means tests and changes to income eligibility that have really pulled back a lot on that practice. Now, there's a big asterisk to that, though, and that's called the Federal Crop Insurance Program. What we've seen is a shift in farm aid away from these sort of direct government payment programs to more of an insurance approach where private insurance companies are heavily subsidized to offer risk management to farmers who will buy these subsidized insurance policies at a cheaper rate than what they would get without government backing. And then the payouts come out, you know, when there's a crop disaster, when there's radical price swings, those sorts of situations. So that's now the foundation of farm aid, and those don't have the same sorts of income limits that you see in the traditional farm program. They also don't have the same transparency. Since these programs are administered through private companies, you don't have the same data of who is getting what farm subsidy that you get from other programs. Of course, farmers love this. You know, they don't want to see the amount of money they're getting from the government put on some website for people to search. But again, for people who really want to understand where every dollar is going and to whom, this gets frustrated because they're seeing, you know, millionaires, they're suspecting, getting these farm subsidy payments, and they feel like they're left in the dark about it.
Well, are lawmakers getting some of these subsidies?
Yes. Lawmakers definitely get farm subsidies because lawmakers farm. And if they qualify under these programs, they receive them just like everyone else. I believe that the count is somewhere in the mid-teens, maybe even higher, as far as the number of farms of politicians who benefit from programs at the congressional level. But that's been an ongoing thing, and that's been an ongoing criticism as well.
And why the lack of transparency? I mean, is it because they can, in a sense, get away with it, or there isn't enough pressure to have more transparency about this bill?
Well, you'd have to say there isn't, you know, enough pressure from the standpoint of getting that transparency, because if you had enough pressure, you'd get the transparency.
Right.
There's a lot of arguments made as to why this isn't done. You know, there are a lot of federal programs out there that people benefit from, and not necessarily every piece of the data is public. Farm subsidies are a particularly sensitive spot, because there's a lot of people who believe that farm subsidies simply shouldn't be going out. And if a member of Congress is essentially voting themselves money, you know, that rubs a lot of people the wrong way. Over the years, the trend has been towards more transparency. I mean, you've seen more information reported because of the pressure of these groups. But this particular farm bill, especially as we've seen the shift from the traditional subsidy programs more to crop insurance, they really feel that transparency took a step backwards this time around.
I'm actually looking at something from the Environmental Working Group. You were wondering about how many lawmakers. They've found something like 15 lawmakers and their spouses who own farms collected a total of almost $238,000 in subsidy payments. This is actually from the Washington Post, barely noticeable amid the billions of dollars in payments, but still notable.
Right, and something else I will point out about that, though, just in terms of fully understanding the terms you're dealing with, those numbers are going back to 1995, and if you look at those individual lawmakers, and I did look at those individual lawmakers, a lot of those payments end around the 2008 Farm Bill, when you had some changes in terms of qualifications for subsidies. Now, another reason why you see some of those payments end is, again, the reporting requirements on some of this stuff is not as direct as it used to be. So there's reason to believe that there is, A, less aid going out to lawmakers, but B, what aid does go out is tougher to track.
And that's Alan Bierga. He covers agricultural policy for Bloomberg News, joining us in this portion of Radio Times to talk about the farm bill that was just passed, taking us through the sausage-making of legislation, what's in the bill, what's not in the bill. And he's the author of a book called Endless Appetites, How the Commodities Casino Creates Hunger and Unrest. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Any questions or comments, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Let me get, looks like Mark from Mickleton, New Jersey, to join us. And Mark, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
So my question for your guest is, I understand that there's a pretty strong correlation between commodity crop subsidy and the rise in processed foods, high fructose corn syrup being kind of the poster child for that. And that a big beneficiary, as much as farmers for crop subsidies, are the businesses that make the processed food. So I'm wondering if your guest can speak to that, and also speak to how maybe this new subsidy moving more towards crop insurance and direct payments might affect that relationship.
Mark, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Alan, you want to take that?
Yeah, you know, what the caller is talking about is a concern that people have had many times about the relationship between farm subsidies and nutrition outcomes. You know, and the question becomes a correlation causation argument. There's no doubt that there is a correlation that, you know, farm subsidies, you know, that have benefited growers of major commodity crops, you know, especially things like corn, wheat, soybeans, have coincided with the rise of the processed food industry in the United States. Now, whether that correlation is actually a causation is an argument that you can have all day. But in terms of how the new farm bill shifts things, these direct payments definitely were concentrated toward the major commodity growers. And a lot of your crop insurance, you know, premium subsidies and payouts also go to those large growers, because they're the ones who are growing the bulk of crops in the United States. About 80% of the food created in this country is grown by about 10 to 15% of the farmers. The insurance is more widely dispersed. You know, while direct payments may have been concentrated to a certain number of crops, insurance policies exist for, you know, pretty much everyone. Although, interestingly enough, some of the adoption rates are tougher in those fruit and vegetable areas, just because they're in climates where the weather risk is not considered to be as great as, say, wheat country or the Corn Belt. So You could say you'll have a shift in policy, but maybe some of the same outcomes. The question about how that affects nutrition kind of then becomes a separate issue, because that gets into questions about, you know, because the U.S. grows so much corn, does that encourage high fructose corn syrup? In fact, high fructose corn syrup consumption peaked about 12 years ago because it can't compete on price with ethanol, which has actually emerged as the big use of corn in the United States. And however you feel about ethanol, that may be something different, but these are difficult connections to tease out. How the Farm Bill changes it, we don't know, because crop insurance policies work differently than direct payments, but the preliminary indications would be, you know, probably not much.
Mark, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. You know, as you're describing this Farm Bill, Alan, I'm trying to imagine a country without a Farm Bill, without these subsidies, without the food and nutrition programs. It's sort of hard to imagine what this country would be like, if we could even have the kinds of programs that we have, or even have the kind of food that we have, without a Farm Bill.
Well, you raise a really important point, because, you know, agriculture is one of the most subsidized industries worldwide. That's why agriculture is such a big issue before the World Trade Organization, because they're highly complex policies. They're very protected. You know, a lot of countries are much more rural and much more agrarian than the United States is, and they you know, protect their farmers as well. The European Union's common agricultural policy throws out a lot in subsidies. Japan is highly protectionist. So agriculture production subsidies are nothing, they're not anything that's unique to the United States. And then things like the food stamp program, you know, we call it food stamps here, but it's really something that is common in a lot of countries, which is, you know, you call it a consumption subsidy. This is basically a transfer payment encouraging people to buy food. And in the United States, it's a food stamp program, but in other countries, you know, part of the reason you've had bread riots in countries like Egypt is because you have a lot of countries that artificially control the price of bread. You know, they want to keep this from creating unrest. That's a lot of what my book is about, actually. And food becomes very emotional and very political, because it's literally the stuff of life. And it makes economies work, and it becomes part of global trade and global pride. And you see these debates the world over. If you want to imagine a country that doesn't have farm subsidies, probably the closest example is New Zealand. New Zealand got rid of a lot of all this stuff, you know, within the last 20 years, and they have a thriving dairy sector. They have a thriving livestock sector. They seem to be surviving okay, but they are very much the exception. Globally, they are not the rule.
Is there any way to know the international or the global implications of this bill as it essentially comes into law and comes into being?
Well, I'll give you a couple of very specific examples, because there were a few countries that were watching the U.S. Farm Bill very closely. One of that was Brazil. Brazil won a WTO case a few years back against U.S. cotton policy, and the WTO has given them the right to retaliate against a wide range of U.S. trade goods, because U.S. cotton policy is seen as trade distorting. The U.S. has actually staved off that retaliation, and I know some of your listeners are going to think this is incredibly crazy, but right now the U.S. is paying about $150 million a year to Brazil's cotton farmers, basically to stave off WTO retaliation across the board.
Wow.
Brazil is looking at this farm bill and deciding whether the U.S. changes to its cotton program are enough for them not to go back to the WTO, but we could see another round of that. Other countries that have been watching this farm bill closely are Canada and Mexico. In the 2002 farm bill and reaffirmed in 2008, the last two iterations, there was this provision called country of origin labeling, where if you take a look at a meat cut that you buy in a grocery store, you can tell what country it came from. Canada and Mexico have been challenging this before the WTO as well. They have been winning. They were hoping that changes would be made in this farm bill that would bring the U.S. more in WTO compliance. The U.S. says that they are, but all the indications are that Canada and Mexico are going to disagree, and that because of this farm bill, the U.S. is going to be facing more cases before the WTO, because their policy will be seen as more protectionist.
What does this farm bill do about dairy policy?
Dairy actually was one of the most controversial parts of this farm bill. Ironically, it was part of the reason the farm bill got passed. If you had not gotten a piece of legislation, eventually the USDA was going to have to start implementing programs from the father of all farm bills, passed in 1949, which is what the law reverts to when you don't have a reauthorization. That would have potentially doubled the price of milk. Instead, we got a farm bill that basically, once again, replaces a lot of very complicated payment, marketing order, set price type programs, and replaces it with an insurance type program that's based on profit margins. One of the concerns about this new program was they were afraid that if you are essentially allowing farmers to insure a profit margin, that will encourage a glut of milk. That might be good for consumers in the short term, but it would be chaos for the industry because you'd throw a lot of producers out of business. You have all this milk that you didn't need. There was an idea that you might want to do some things in this bill that would help manage the supply. John Boehner and House Republicans said, no, that's the sort of stuff they used to do in the Soviet Union. We're not going to have production targets. But what they came up with was a compromise where if the supplies get to be too much, there could be some government intervention, there could be some changes in incentives. It should make dairy policy more rational or at least smoother from an administrative standpoint. How it affects milk prices remains to be seen, though there are people who are concerned that this is going to lead to a glut.
Have you read all, I think it's almost 1,000 pages, have you read all 1,000 pages of this farm bill?
If I did, I may be the only person in America who
I was wondering about that. I mean, whether it's even necessary to do that. No, go ahead, Alan.
Well, what happens is, that legislative language, a lot of it is language referring to other bills. So when people say you haven't read the whole bill, well, even if you read the whole bill, if you don't understand every other farm bill that's been passed before it, you're not going to have any idea what this language means. But what you can do is you can have folks looking at different sections, different parts, analyzing different pieces, and by the time you're done with it, you get a pretty good sense of everything that is in the bill and what the implications are. You know, this is one thing about our social media, everything on the internet age. A lot of people start looking into different portions really fast, and through crowdsourcing, you can get a real sense of what is going on in this piece of legislation. You may not agree with what's in these bills, and they may be passed a little too quickly to examine everything, but it doesn't take too long for everybody to pretty much pick this thing through and people have a sense of what's going on.
So 10 years, this bill is in effect for 10 years? We're almost out of time here, but go ahead, Alan.
It's in effect for 5 years. Congressional estimates are always done on a 10-year scale, but this will be the law of the land until 2018, 2019.
And do you predict another wrestling match over that farm bill?
Absolutely, because if you don't pass another one, you could have a reversion to 1949 and milk prices potentially double again. Nobody will want that.
Well, thank you so much for walking us through a very complicated piece of legislation. I appreciate it. Alan Bierga, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And he covers agricultural policy for Bloomberg News and, again, wrote a book called Endless Appetites, How the Commodities Casino Creates Hunger and Unrest. We have Eric Hurst waiting in the wings. We do want to talk about the upcoming weather forecast for the region and also talk about how meteorologists do their job and how social media can complicate their job. Do stay with us and give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen, and stay with us. We'll be right back.
Support for WHYY comes from Delaware Valley College. Delaware Valley College offers a Master of Arts in Counseling Psychology that prepares culturally competent practitioners to work in the mental health field. Students can choose from social justice community counseling or child and adolescent counseling. More information about a Master of Arts in Counseling Psychology from Delaware Valley College is available online at delval.edu/grad.
She's a nationally renowned broadcast journalist and a special correspondent for NPR. She was co-host of All Things Considered for 14 years and has won every major award in broadcasting. She's been considered an NPR founding mother and has been with the network since it began in 1971. Her thousands of interviews include conversations with Rosa Parks, Laura Bush, Billy Crystal, Dave Brubeck, and Luciano Pavarotti. I'm talking about Susan Stamberg, and I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Join me for a very special evening on Wednesday, June 11th at 7 p.m. when I sit down with Susan and talk about her career. You can be part of the audience for a pledge of $10 per month as a new sustainer. Just tell our phone volunteer that you would like to sign up to automatically renew your pledge. Here's that phone number. It's 1-888-345-9499. Let me give it to you again. 1-888-345-WHYY. We'll see you on June 11th. Thanks. This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Well, it looks like another snowstorm is headed to the Philadelphia region. That's according to professional forecasters. Last week, a forecast appeared on someone known as Weather Boy Weather's Facebook page, predicting 30 inches of snow for this past weekend. The National Weather Service had to issue a bulletin debunking that rumor. We asked Eric Hurst, meteorologist and director of the Weather Information Center at Millersville University, to join us on Radio Times and to talk about separating forecasts from fiction. Eric Hurst, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Good to be with you.
Nice to have you with us. And again, to our listeners, 1-888-477-9499. Eric, I want to take advantage of your forecasting skills. A winter storm warning in effect. What does that mean for the Philadelphia region?
You bet. A sloppy mix of varying precipitation. It's going to probably start and end as snow in Philadelphia, but in between the start and the end, there's also going to be some sleet, some freezing rain, even some plain rain areas from I-95 eastward. And so a real sloppy mix of precipitation. As a rule of thumb, the farther north and west you go, northern and western suburbs, especially as you head up towards Allentown and over towards Harrisburg, that's where they'll see, that's where mostly snow will fall, and I believe probably a foot or so in those locations. Of course, as you head the other direction from I-95 towards the coast, it'll be mostly rain with just a little bit of snow at the beginning and end. So, you know, the Philadelphia area is right on the fence with this event, and I think when it's all said and done, 3 to 6 inches in downtown Philly, higher amounts, again, as you go north and west, and lesser amounts to the south and east.
Are computer models, predicting models, are they getting more accurate?
Yeah, I'll tell you, it's a fascinating subject, and there's a wide range of computer models. They've become very specialized tools in recent years. There's computer models that are specialized to specifically forecast hurricanes and severe thunderstorms. And then, of course, there's global computer models that we use to deal with more typical events like rainstorms and winter storms. And then, you know, there's different agencies, even different countries, the weather services in the UK and in Canada and in Japan and here in the United States all have computer models that we freely share with each other. So where we've ended up here in 2014 is almost, sensory overload, there's so many different products to look at, and that, you know, a meteorologist could spend hours or, you know, really 24 hours with an upcoming storm looking at different models, and it really becomes overwhelming, and that's where the experienced, you know, kind of veteran forecaster comes in, because right away you can look at different models and say, well, that's out to lunch. That's, you know, these models, as good as they can be some days, are highly flawed on other days. So that's really the art of weather forecasting is if you blindly interpret a weather model, at best you're going to issue a mediocre forecast and it could be a downright horrible forecast. The art of weather forecasting is learning which model to use on a given day, you know, which one appears to be on the right track based on your experience, and also knowing the biases of the models. You know, computer models are designed by people, and people have biases and computer models have biases. So, you know, there's certain models that tend to over-forecast rain and snow, and some that under-forecast it. And then there's temperature biases. So it really is an art, taking the output from these models, their simulations of how a storm is going to form and evolve, and then turn that into a forecast that is usable by the public and usable by decision makers. And here's where, you know, kind of the problems have, you know, like what you described, what happened last week is, most of this computer guidance is available over the internet to the public. So there's, you know, weather's a fantastic hobby. That's how I got started as a teenager back in the 70s. Weather was a hobby. But all I had was 3 minutes on the evening news to really watch, or maybe a clip in the newspaper. Today, kids or adults who are weather hobbyists have largely the same tools to look at, the same models as the professionals do, but they don't have the training. They don't have the degree in meteorology that teaches you how these models work and how the atmosphere works. And they obviously wouldn't have the experience of a veteran forecaster who's been doing it for 10 or 20 or 30 years like myself. So when you have amateurs trying to interpret these products, the best they can do is a very superficial assessment of what the models are saying, and that's where these crazy forecasts come out. These weather bloggers, weather hobbyists, and they might look at one model that implies 30 inches of snow, whereas the experienced meteorologist like myself just says that's out to lunch.
Well, which is interesting that the National Weather Service actually had to issue a bulletin debunking that forecast for last week. And I have to say, taking the train, someone turned to me and said, this was last week, saying, did you know we're going to get 30 inches of snow this coming up weekend? Of course,
yeah.
It didn't happen. But, you know, the rumor, the story was out there.
You bet. And, I'm up here in Lancaster County at Millersville University, and I heard the exact same rumors. I got in Monday morning last week, and my email box was full, had numerous emails from people that had in one way or another heard the rumor of a blizzard. And I was in here last Monday preparing a forecast about a major ice storm that was going to affect, eastern Pennsylvania, and of course was the worst ice storm in about a decade in many areas, and hundreds of thousands of people lost power. And instead of being able to focus on getting that message out early last week, I had to kind of put out this fire. And I think that's why Philadelphia Weather Service Office put that message out, kind of trying to, out the fire, once and for all on that rumored blizzard that, of course, never materialized and never was going to materialize. I'll tell you, in terms of that specific rumor last week, although that one blogger you mentioned who issued that map might have got things started, there were also a few professional meteorologists that I think got carried away. I don't want to name anybody specifically, but somebody on the Weather Channel mentioned the idea that a weekend storm could cause snowfall that would be measured in feet in the northeastern U.S. I believe that was last Monday as well. So while the amateur bloggers might have got things started, a couple of the pros fell for it as well. And that happens sometimes, because especially for folks in the TV business, they're trying to get viewers, trying to get ratings. And, a long time ago, TV stations discovered that snow equals ratings. And, I don't know if how many of your listeners remember back in the winter, I think it was March 2001, John Belaris went on WCAU and rung the bell that a storm of the century was coming. And he said that like 7 days in advance. And, of course, It never materialized.
And we know what happened to him.
Exactly. Well, that kind of precipitated him moving on at that, in the year or two that followed. And he was highly criticized just because he made such a sensational call many days in advance. And the fact is, as good as our computer models have become in the past decade, they're still flawed. And to make such a bold forecast, whether it was that blogger last week or John Belaris a decade ago, you don't make that bold of a forecast a week out, because the fact are, I'll tell you, the storm coming here tomorrow still has, there's still some uncertainty with it. And hence, back here in Lancaster County where I'm at, whether we mix over to sleet at the peak of the storm is going to determine whether we end up with, 6 or 7 inches or 12 or 14 inches. And we're just 24 hours away from the peak of the storm. So, weather forecasting is never, probably not in our lifetime, is going to be so precise that we can nail things down. And, when you're out 5 to 7 days in the future, I think you need to talk about potential. And at least my philosophy is you don't talk inches. You don't start throwing out ranges of snowfall that far in advance. I kind of wait till about 3 days before the storm, and that's a reasonable time to start talking accumulation. So,
but you get the sense, I certainly do, that we have become a weather-obsessed people. And I think because it is possible to, go on the internet and check and see what folks are predicting, whether they're professionals or they're amateurs. And perhaps it's been a difficult winter, so we are obsessed about the weather these days. Do you feel that?
Yeah. Well, no doubt. I mean, what thing, is there in our lives that affects everybody? you know, some of us are into the Philadelphia Eagles, but some of us aren't, you know, so either, you know, but weather affects us all, you know, so it's the ultimate in water cooler talk and kind of gossiping and speculation. And, of course, it can have life or death impacts of, you know, potentially in certain situations. And, you know, so, and when it comes to the internet and television, you know, weather's kind of the ultimate reality TV, and that's why all these shows on storm chasing have become so popular. Is it's reality TV, and a type that can actually affect us in our personal lives. So that makes it very engaging, and there's definitely a growing number of weather hobbyists and weather enthusiasts, you know, that can, you can be an armchair forecaster at home by coming into a website and viewing computer models. But unfortunately, without the training, without, you know, students spend 4 years at a school like Millersville University or Penn State studying meteorology, learning the nuts and bolts of the atmosphere and how computer models work and how to use them as tools. And then after that, they get jobs and they train and they, you know, spend decades honing their craft. Well, then you have an armchair, whether it's an amateur high school forecaster or an adult, out there issuing maps, issuing forecasts. I have a real problem with that. And to be honest, you know, most professional meteorologists do, because, and this is something that's just developed in the last couple of years through social media, is these amateur forecasters building websites that look professional. You know, it's anybody these days can build a fairly professional looking website themselves. And, you know, so you discover, you know, an unknowing person or media member or decision maker discovers a new website, and oh, it's another AccuWeather, it's another Weather Channel, it's another, you know, it looks professional, and then you see these crazy forecasts and think, oh my goodness. And it's not. It's an amateur pretending, you know, somebody pretending to be a meteorologist. And there's, you know, been,
well, you know, Eric, yeah,
there's been a rapid rise in these type of websites.
Yeah, I hear
it's
you.
Really quite alarming.
Let me get a caller, and it looks like we have Jack from Cherry Hill joining us on Radio Times. And Jack, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, hello. I live in Cherry Hill, and I'm a very web. I spend a lot of time on the internet.
You and everyone
AARP,
else.
Yeah. Huh?
I said you and everybody else, but no, go ahead.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Jack.
AARP sent out a warning last night, which really upset me. They claim we're going to get 18 to 22 inches in the band that between the shore and the other side of Philadelphia. Now, where'd they get that, and how accurate is that? Do I have to worry about 18 inches of snow? And the last time you had, what, 14 inches in Philadelphia, and we had four, right?
Well, you know what, but Eric, and this is an interesting point, which is, you know, go to the National Weather Service, go to these services that have a track record that actually hire meteorologists to do the work. Jack, hold on. Let me give Eric a chance to respond.
Yeah, well, first of all, Jack, in terms of that forecast with the really large snow totals, that's highly unlikely with this storm. What you described would be a very historic event for New Jersey to get that kind of snow. This storm, there's going to be quite a bit of mild air moving in off the ocean that will cause a changeover and a mix. And as I said, I think it starts and ends as snow in New Jersey, but there'll be quite a bit of rain and sleet mixed in during the peak of the storm. So that should hold snow totals down areas east of I-95. Now, as you head up to Lehigh Valley, parts of Bucks County, you get back into Montgomery County, Berks County, you know, northern Chester, Lancaster, I think there'll be a foot of snow in places. Perhaps, you know, there could be a bullseye of 18. I would not rule that out.
Right.
But again, the farther south and east you go, the more mixed. So this is a major storm, no doubt about it. But it's not one of those 2 foot or, you know, the January 96 blizzard is really the benchmark of the modern era. You know, it dumped up to 30 inches on the region. This is not that kind of storm, but it is a plowable heavy snow, and it's going to cause for treacherous travel late tonight and throughout pretty much all of Thursday, region-wide. And, of course, this storm, it's snowing all the way back into the deep south this morning. It's going to snow all the way to Maine. So this is a big-ticket item, the largest nor'easter of the season here, but I don't think it's going to be one of these worst-case storms of the century. It's going to be significant but not crippling.
Jack, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Eric, we're almost out of time here, but one feels living in the Philadelphia area that this is the worst winter we've ever had. It's been cold. We've had this mix of precipitation, and it's been it feels like a very long winter. How does this one stack up? Give us a reality check.
Right. Well, in terms of total snowfall, we're not in record territory yet. We would need another, I don't know exactly what the official number is for downtown Philly right now, but, certainly Philadelphia, most of eastern Pennsylvania is way above, probably at 150% of normal snowfall at this point, and we're going to add to that, no doubt. I see the light at the end of the tunnel, though. I see warmer weather trying to develop late in this month into early March, and so I don't think it will end up being the snowiest winter on record here, but as you correctly pointed out, it's been, started snowing here in early December in Pennsylvania this winter, and it has been a long cold run for us, and temperature wise it may end up being the coldest winter in 10 to 20 years. We'll have to wait till winter's officially over to run those numbers, and we could go over that maybe when spring arrives.
Well, fair enough. Eric Hurst, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Good to be here.
And he's a meteorologist, director of the Weather Information Center at Millersville University, giving us an update on the weather that is headed our way, and talking a bit about the problem of rumors and fake weather sites, and trying to bring a bit of a reality check as we all deal with this, what feels like very long and difficult winter. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us for hour two. We'll be right back.